of Scottish pop with Vic Galloway on BBC Radio Scotland.
In this episode, we look at the harder seam of rock running through contemporary Scottish music. It's all about uncompromising attitude and loud guitars. We have achieved so much more than you possibly thought we could. Over the next hour, you'll hear how Shirley Manson cut her teeth musically.
It was my real experience with rock and roll, like proper debauched, outrageous punk rock.
Why Biffy Clyro are still humble.
You know, we never saw ourselves as a band that would ever kind of get to this scale or size.
And why at heart, an early incarnation of Simple Minds were punk through and through.
And in true punk fashion, we split up on the day the record was released.
As a youngster, punk and hard rock blew my mind and helped me enjoy the visceral thrill of louder, wilder music. And like many others, it still does. It would be remiss of a programme about Scottish rock not to mention Alex Harvey, someone who influenced countless others, including a young Richard Jobson.
The biggest Scottish musical influence on me has always been a Glaswegian frontman called Alex Harvey from a band called the Sensational Alex Harvey Band. And I went to see them with my oldest brother. My oldest brother became a Hare Krishna monk, and I'd go to his temple in Edinburgh and pick him up, and we'd either go and see really violent movies in the afternoon and then go and see bands. And he always managed to get the tickets or get in free because he was this kind of weird, strange enigma, and they just couldn't deny him entry, and we would get in the backstage doors or whatever. And we went to see Alex Harvey supporting Mott the Hoople, but then this guy called Alex Harvey came on as a support act, and I'd never seen anything like it, because I'm a great fan of comic books at the time, Marvel comic books, and of course, which evolved into really elegant graphic novels. And he seemed like a character from that, larger than life. He had that feral thing that I could relate to, and he was just a great frontman. I don't think I really connected with the music that much, but I connected with him and the way he presented himself as an enigma, the sense that you could be aggressive, but at the same time have a kind of tenderness in your music.
A generation before Richard Jobson, the band Nazareth laid the groundwork for forthcoming Scottish rockers, wearing their influences as proudly as the Skids. Here's Pete Agnew from the band on how rock formed in the 1960s.
Basically, all the best singers and the great songs were all soul songs in the mid-60s and stuff. It was really, you know, I mean, there was nothing. I mean, come on, you know, we had Herman's Hermits singing No Milk Today. My love has gone away. The bottle stands forlorn, a symbol of the dawn. I mean, you couldn't take that kind of thing seriously, you know. So, I mean, we were looking for something else. Up in Scotland especially, the soul scene was always big. And Otis Redding, you know, was the best singer in the world as far as we were concerned. Call me Mr. Pitiful. Baby, that's my name. I think what happened, though, the soul thing became really big because there wasn't any rock, you know? I mean, other than Chuck Berry going way back. But the time you got up to maybe 69, around about that time, when you got people like 68, 69, or the people like Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin. These kind of heavier bands, if you like, at the time. There was nothing like that in the mid-60s. It was pop. There were great pop songs. I mean, come on, you had the Beatles and you had all these, you know, Sgt. Pepper and that kind of thing. But it was 20 years ago today, Sgt. Pepper taught the band to play. I'm sorry, but Sgt. Pepper wasn't rock and roll, you know? It was, maybe it had been a masterpiece, but it was not rock and roll.
A contemporary band that certainly rock are Twin Atlantic. I was keen to pick up why the band prefer their music a little bit on the heavier side with lead singer Sam McTrusty.
I don't have a choice. It's something that I've actually tried to fight a few times because being Scottish and being involved in rock music is kind of like showing a dog a card trick. No one's expecting it. They don't even know what to make of it at first. They don't really take it particularly seriously in a credible way. That's kind of my experience around the world anyway. But myself and Ross, our bass player, we just need it to kick a little bit harder. The drums, the bass, the guitar, it just needs to be a little bit more forward for us to think that it's good and to enjoy it. The lyrical side that I feel that rock, for me personally, has always been like the voice of the people for different generations, different times through music. That's just the thing that kind of speaks to me in the most honest way.
Being Scottish and making rock music, do you feel it's a natural fit or an unnatural fit?
It feels quite natural for me, whether that's to do with it like making me feel good because it's loud, or it's just like a bit of a kind of outlet of like teenage angst. I flick the switch on the generator so I can turn you on. You better get to know your operator before you pack that tool.
Honeyblood are a guitar and drums duo who definitely upped their game on second album Babes Never Die, fulfilling their potential to rock that bit harder. Here's Stina Tweedale from the band.
It was very intentional to make Babes a different sort of record. Babes is such a power shot. It's like a snapshot of my life rather than a full kind of like couple of years. I'm extremely proud of that record, especially with Kat joining and just like making the band the potential that the band had musically. When it comes to she came and played on the first, you know, for the first tour that we did, the first headline tour, she came and played the old record. And she was just like, cool, I mean, this is fine, but I'm going to just speed everything up because I think it needs to be a bit more punchy. And I was like instantly so up for that. And the songs kind of came to life. I think a lot of the time we got pigeonholed as an indie band with distortion, I guess. The second record is very more direct and to the point and more kind of rock, I guess, which is probably where me and Kat feel more comfortable. And I think, it's half moshable too.
Someone else who makes music that is at the very least half moshable is Shirley Manson.
What was the learning curve like playing with Goodbye Mr. McKenzie? 10 years, quite a long time to be with a band.
It was incredible. I mean, even looking back on it now, it's sort of my real experience with rock and roll, like proper debauched, outrageous punk rock. In Goodbye Mr. McKenzie was John Duncan, who was formerly of The Exploited, and he's a proper, you know, rock and roll rebel and was outrageous. I mean, I've seen him do some outrageous things, you know. That was my introduction, and I'm really grateful for it because nothing else has ever fazed me. You know, I lived through it with Goodbye Miss McKenzie, so by the time I became sort of successful with Garbage, I think people thought they could shock me, and I was unshockable, truly, because nobody ever will be as rock and roll as John Duncan.
I'm glad to hear that, actually.
What goes on the road stays on the road.
Well, give us a few just highlights of that 10 years with Goodbye Mr. McKenzie.
Well, first of all, we toured and toured and toured in the back of a transit van everywhere, you know, whether it was locally up to Dingwall in Scotland or down to record a John Peel session or Janice Long session. I just got a taste of everything with that band, and it was really my training ground for what was to come. But I didn't know that at the time.
Ian Bain wasn't too surprised when we tried to find out what Run Rig were.
The perennial question of what is Run Rig? Who are we and what do we want? we've never fitted in. You know, we're too folky for the Rockies. We're too rocky for the folkies. We're not from the urban Glasgow rock scene. We don't fit in with that image. We don't fit in with that. So we've been castigated so many times in the press because they can't pigeonhole us. The broadsheets used to take great pleasure in castigating their audience once they couldn't think of anything else to say about us, because they couldn't finish us off, so they had to turn their attentions to our fan base. So they started slagging them off. And, you know, I remember one saying, Rundgren are obviously tapping into a new form of energy from the all the bald heads in the audience. You know, so they couldn't think of anything else to say that we were rubbish for. So what are we? We are who we are. We're a rock band that sings some songs in Gaelic.
When it comes to rock bands, the name is key. Simple Minds' Jim Kerr knew that all too well with his first band, Johnny and the Self-Abusers.
We would have stayed in that basement had it not been for a guy called John Malarkey, who was at Holyrood School, a bit older than us. We'd heard that John had this imaginary band, imaginary in as much as they never did anything, but everyone heard the name Johnny and the Self-Abusers. I think it was sort of sprayed on a few walls, and it was already mythical. John approached us one night, and he had kind of half a band, and we had half a band, and he said, look, the owner of the Duncastle pub has called my bluff. He said, I've gone in there every night and heckled every band I could heckle that were playing. The owner had finally said to John, right, well, let's see what you can do. You're on a week on Monday, you and your Johnny and the Self-Abusers. And so John came to Charlie and I and said, well, you know, you've got some equipment and you like the same records as me. Shall we have a rehearsal and see what we can do? And Johnny and the Self-Abusers, not only did we play the gigs, which was amazing, but we made one single called Saints and Sinners. And in true punk fashion, we split up on the day the record was released.
I know, that is fantastic.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
That is the most punk thing you'd ever do, split up on the day the single's released.
It's good. As much as Johnny and the Self-Abusers, people say, what was it like being in Johnny and the Self-Abusers? I said, if you could imagine, remember the TV show, The Young Ones? It was kind of like that, only with guitars. And we stayed up in this flat in Partick and were signing on and all that. And it was really all a bit of a joke. It stopped being a joke, the first gig, because, you know, people talk about their first gig and usually they play two people and a dog, and that's the way it goes. Well, when we turned up at our first gig, there was queues around the blocks. The punks knew about it. They were starved of anything that was a kind of a punk noise. So as soon as there was anything that had that attitude, word spread like wildfire. So we turned up to play, and at 4 o'clock, I mean, it was free to get in right enough, but nevertheless, there was queues around the block, and we started, and it was probably terrible, but there was something about it. There was a visceral thing about it. And I'm convinced Charlie and I looked at each other and went, this is just amazing that you can do this thing and people jump up and down, and what a great thing to be part of.
I mean, Simple Minds went on to have huge global success, but do you remember it as a steady build-up? I see sort of New Gold Dream as the breakthrough, but could you feel it building at the time?
We certainly could. I mean, it was pretty much... we only had one thing in our mind, apart from we wanted to be in a band. We wanted to be in a great live band, particularly, and we wanted that great live band to be international. We wanted it to be worldwide. Now, I don't know how we got those notions, but I think it was from going to gigs and seeing. We saw loads of bands. We saw good bands. We saw very good bands, and then we saw great live bands. Now, when I say great, I mean that I'm not talking about musically. Bands that could really transmit. There was definitely bands that could do that, and we wanted to be one of them. We didn't have a clue how to do it, but we just knew we had to get out and do it. And pretty much that's been our modus operandi from first day until now. We're still working. We still see ourselves working with the challenge of that. We haven't done it yet.
Jim Kerr encapsulates something about what it means to be in a rock band, to be a hard worker. You're listening to The Story of Scottish Pop with me, Vic Galloway. This week, I'm looking at some of the rock and roll that Scotland's produced over the years. Along with Jim Kerr, another time-served rocker is Pete Agnew, one of the founding members of Nazareth.
We always liked to play live. We were never just like what you call a recording band, you know? And we always considered ourselves like a working band. It would be funny because we'd, you know, you'd be going out to do a tour and people would say, they would say to you things like, you know, oh, you must use our PA system or our PA and lights. No, because they say, well, you know, because we do the Rolling Stones. And we'd think, well, good for you. So that means, you know, you go out once every 5 years. You know, back at that time, say, what we wanted was the guys that were doing Status Quo, or Rory Gallagher, or Motorhead. You know, these were working bands. These were bands that went out and they sung for the supper, you know. And they played all the time, full date sheets. And we were the same. And it was, that was our approach. We thought, well, you're a band. That's your job. That's what you want to go out and do, you know. We didn't want to make a record and be off the road for 9 months. I didn't see the sense in that, you know. Didn't see the sense in that at all.
Today, there are new generations of hard-working rock bands, of course. You mentioned Biffy Clyro earlier on, mm-hmm. and their importance as a band for helping future generations of Scottish bands. How important were they to you?
I mean, without their band, our band wouldn't exist. I've gotten to know them quite well over the years, and they took us on one of our sort of professional tours, and they just kind of like showed us the ropes massively. I didn't realise it at the time. See all the little details that you don't even think about, like how you get your amp in and out of a venue. They were slagging us at the time. They were kind of like whipping us into shape to be like, guys, if you're going to do it, at least like do it properly. And they've kind of always kind of kept us under their wing that way. So I feel really spoiled because there was a huge influx of bands around. You know, when I was 17, 18, everyone wanted to be in Biffy Clyro. Everyone was doing taking their top off and playing to try and like catch a bit of that kind of magic that they were creating at the time. So I feel really lucky that out of all those bands of my generation, we were the ones that were allowed to kind of grow a little bit, step out of that shadow and actually have a shot at being our own thing. But the Biffy guys, credit to them, because they've really kind of been not just like the pioneers, but also the sort of like, they're going to be annoyed at me because I'm making them sound like they're old guys now, but sort of like the forefathers of it all. They've kind of like helped a lot of bands along the way. Line up your soldiers one final time, we're gonna have a ball. How do you feel about your kind of impact as a band, especially in Scotland? I mean, do you feel like almost, I know you're still young, but you feel like sort of godfathers of the scene or?
No. No, our hearts and souls are too young for that. But it's an honour, you know, when you hear about young bands, you know, that are really great bands that have taken some kind of inspiration from us is fantastic, even if it's just work ethic or anything. And all we ever tell young bands is just make sure you enjoy what you're doing. You know, like, don't do this to make money or to anything like that. If you enjoy hanging out with your mates and making music, then that's the real reason to do it. And, you know, you could potentially be doing what we're doing now, you know, because that's all we did. It's just amazing. I think the Scottish rock scene's always been really strong, you know, but I think we're very proud to come from this part of the world.
Biffy Clyro there, bashful as ever about their place in Scotland's rock canon.
I always saw music as something more than just a hobby, definitely.
Stina Tweeddale again.
It was something that I kind of wanted to pursue, but it's that kind of pipe dream where you never think that you will ever have this lucky chance to do it as a profession. I still don't even think of it as my proper profession. I feel like I'm living like some sort of like weird fake life. But yeah, I always kind of took it very seriously and worked super hard. The band before I was in Honeyblood like would just practice constantly. And that's where I kind of like learned to become a performer, because I never really saw myself as a performer before I was in that band, where I was the singer in that band and what I would call like the front person. I don't really think of myself as a front person now. I think of myself as more, you know, a songwriter and a musician and an artist. But I think performance is something that if it doesn't come naturally to you, you really have to work on it. So that is something that I put a lot of time and effort into. Because it can be quite daunting to get on a stage. And just because you like playing music and you like to sing doesn't mean that you actually have that kind of like extrovert personality, which means that you can get up on a stage. So yeah, that's something I definitely worked at.
Not only does Stina appreciate the support of Honeyblood's fan base, but as a music fan herself, she's cited Shirley Manson of Garbage as an influence. Another artist who appreciates her fans.
I think the most profound for me is some of the letters we've received from people of what our music has done for them, literally gotten them through deaths or rapes or murders or sexual transitions. And I got just a note recently from a father who was thanking the band for certain songs in our roster that helped his daughter transitioned from a boy to the woman she is, and that the father was saying thank you so much because her mother and I didn't understand what was happening, and your band did, and your band saved my daughter's life. You know, if I die tomorrow, I will have serviced mankind for that deed alone. Like, you know, it's, mm-hmm. Again, it sounds like such a cliche, but it's the greatest privilege of my career.
What you've meant to young women as well, I think it must mean a lot to you. You really have inspired countless young women to be musicians, but also just to live their lives.
Well, thank you.
You must have young women come up to you after shows, or if they bump into you in the street or whatever, and say nice things to you, do you?
I do, yeah. It's lovely. It's lovely. Yeah. I mean, I know how much my musical Joan of Arc's meant to me. I mean, when I met Patti Smith, I burst into tears, you know. And you can't put it into words, really, what it is they give you, but they give you something that nobody else can through music, you know. So, I mean, again, as I'm getting older, I feel more and more maternal towards the fans. At first, you know, when you first emerge, they're almost your peers. It's very uncomfortable. But I'm in this glorious phase of my career where I feel maternal and I feel like I can take care of them, or I can help them or lift them up. And I feel more and more that I want to be in service of our fans. Whereas when you first start out, you know, it's just, I wanted to show off. I wanted to be listened to. I wanted to be paid attention to. And it's really muddled and weird and uncomfortable. But then if you're around long enough, you're lucky enough to be around long enough, it changes. At least for me, it's changed so much. And I'm like, oh, I'm actually like a nurse. I'm, you know, and once I figured that out, I could become comfortable with meeting fans and giving them autographs and not feeling fake humility or anything. I felt the real thing. I felt like, oh, I'm in service to you, and this is an incredible, you're giving me so much, and let me here, allow me to make you feel good. Mm-hmm. You know,
what about Scottish audiences? I mean,
they're the best.
Yeah,
point blank the best.
Really?
Yes,
because people say that, but I mean, you know, it's quite often, yeah, you guys are the best.
No, I'm telling you right now, I am not very expert at much in my life, but I have played more gigs than most people have had hot dinners, and I'm telling you right now, the Scots are off the charts. Mexicans too. Mexicans and Scots. But when I first brought my band back to Scotland and we were going to play the Barrowlands, and I was literally boasting, like, I'm like, they're going to blow your minds. They're going to blow your minds. And at no point was I worried that I would be proven wrong. And sure enough, we went and played this gig and it was unbelievable. And the band afterwards were like, yep, you were right. It was outrageous.
And what about your massive success? Because Scotland can be envious. It can be jealous sometimes. Have you always felt Scotland's behind you?
Yeah, I have. I've been so... I mean, I could start crying, to be honest, if I tune into this, because it's always the first gigs to sell out, the Scottish gigs. Like, everybody will say, oh, you're struggling to sell tickets, but the Scottish shows are sold out, you know, and I'm like, that means... To me, if I'm selling out in my homeland, that's the most important thing to me. Again, it sounds so cliched and so hokey, but if I'm really honest with myself, that's what matters to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud of the fact that they didn't throw eggs at me when I came back, you know, with all the success that Garbage had. They didn't throw eggs at me, and they could have. Press could have torn me apart, you know, as I've watched them do with, you know, most famously with Sheena Easton when I was growing up. No, I'm lucky.
I know
lucky.
Katie Tunstall says that although she gets an amazing reception at every single Scottish show she ever plays, she is still slightly nervous and apprehensive about playing in Scotland. Does that go through your head?
Well, I'm a lot older than Katie, so I've had a wee bit more experience, I guess. So no, I don't feel that anymore. I used to feel that. I'd be very nervous. Like, the band would always say, you'd go really weird when we came home, or you came home, you know. But now I'm just like, I'm excited. I feel I've earned it too. It's like, you know what, you may hate us or love us, but I'm good at what I do. And I bled out for this. I bled out for it. I'm only happy when it rains. I'm only happy when it rains.
What about the Scottish fans? I mean, you'll have great fans all over the world, but what about your homegrown fans? Are you still out there?
Our fans in Glasgow are so dedicated that it actually takes us back a little bit. Like, we're not really... We weren't prepared for that level of, like, fandom. Do you know what I mean? To people getting tattoos, asking me to write lyrics all the time, people getting that type of dedication to your music just wasn't expected. We don't just, like, sell out gigs here. They sell out in, like, minutes. It's insane. Like, we really didn't think we would ever be one of those bands, and we're forever grateful. That kind of goes hand in hand with why we dedicated an album to the city and stuff, was mostly to kind of show our gratitude to the fans here.
Transmit a serious moment for you, because you got the entire festival jumping. That's got to be one of your best gigs. I mean, certainly that I've seen that reaction. How did that feel?
There's four of us in the band, and there's usually one person who's like, that was an awful show, like in a bad mood and all that. But that's the first time all four of us have agreed that is definitely the best show we've ever played. We felt like it was such a test, like having to prove ourselves, even after over 10 years of doing this. Where we were on the billing, and we didn't expect to have like the full capacity of the venue, because I think it was like 50,000 people were there and we were on in the middle of the day. So it was even more of a test to kind of prove that we deserved to be there, and we just went a bit kind of 10% extra.
Excellent. 110%. Sam McTrusty from Twin Atlantic there. For prog rocker Fish, how a band deals with a fan, be it maternal, supportive, or by giving it 110%, has changed over the last few years.
The way I look at it is that
you know, through the internet, through Facebook, through Twitter, through Instagram, whatever, and obviously through your website, right? Your relationship with a fan has changed. I mean, when I was a fan of Genesis or whatever, you know, back in the mid-70s, you know, you would get one interview that would happen, or a couple of interviews that, you know, would happen, a couple of live reviews, there'd be maybe an article or two, right? But that was it. You wouldn't really hear about the band, you know, they weren't in your face all the time. Now they are. Bands are in your face all the time. On Facebook pages, whatever, there's more information available.
And does that appeal to you? Are you into that?
I enjoy it. Honestly, plays a great part in the way that a truly independent musician is working these days. Because, you know, there are bands out there that just think that they can put out a tiny bit of plastic and they can sell it for $12.99 or $13.99 or whatever. But eventually the fans are not stupid, you know, and they're not cash cows, right? And, you know, you put out two bad albums, one after the other, they're going to question the third, and eventually you will lose them. And I think, you know, one of the most important things is to keep your fan base on your side. So you don't overprice things. You always try and deliver the best quality stuff that you're doing. I mean, not pandering to them. I mean, you still keep your creative integrity. We put a lot of care and attention into delivering them.
Say I love you, boy, but I know you lie. I trust you all the same. I don't know why.
What about the venues you're playing now? Because I saw you when you were playing the Vodka Bar in Belmont Street in Aberdeen, and your first kind of run of small venue gigs around Scotland. It's now arenas and enormous domes, isn't it? What's happening on this forthcoming tour in March and April?
We're going to try and make it bigger and better than ever before. And I think it's important in these shows is to try and make it a bit of a spectacle. You know, we don't see ourselves as entertainers, but we want people to come and feel like they've been for a, you know, an amazing night out. And I think trying to marry that with some sort of intimacy in a big room is something that's quite a challenge, and I think something that we enjoy, that challenge, you know.
Yeah, have you got pyrotechnics and explosions and all sorts of stuff happening on this tour?
We're practicing fire breathing after this interview.
Oh, really? Really? That's what I want to see. It can only be the next move for Biffy Clyro, yeah, is to actually breathe fire on stage. I mean, does it still give you the shivers before you go on stage?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, we never saw ourselves as a band that would ever kind of get to this scale or size, and I think we always have pinch ourselves moments, you know. I think we, even when we're off stage, we kind of forget what's happening, you know, and I think it's a healthy way to be, you know. It doesn't infiltrate every day of our lives, but it also then means when we turn up to these venues, it's like, oh my God, this is where we're playing. And, you know, we want to make those concerts artistically valid and but still a spectacle and still entertaining. And, you know, I think we're still kind of finding our feet in that regard. In the last year or so, or couple of years, we've become a lot more comfortable playing these large shows. And I think this will be our best tour yet. There's no doubt about that. And we can't wait to play these new songs.
Biffy Boys get to the heart of what it means to be in a rock band, to play live. Stina Tweeddale of Honeyblood has also learnt to enjoy being on stage.
I do enjoy being on stage now. I think it really helps to have like a buddy to enjoy it with. I do a couple of solo shows now a year, and I find those very revealing, I guess, is the term I would call them, and very beautiful in ways, because it really means that the songs can show that takes precedence over anything else. But being on stage with a buddy is sometimes just the best feeling ever. Like, I've had fits of laughter on stage because of like the interaction with, like, if we've had an amazing audience and if Kat's like having a good time, then we just have a ball. So that can really makes it not as scary, I guess.
Those on-stage relationships are clearly key to a band having fun live.
Rundrig is stronger than the sum of its parts. We are a unit, and it's a chemistry. If you ask any band that's been together for a long time, it's that chemistry that exists between people that you can't invent, you can't design, you can't, you know, contrive it. It's either there or it's not there. And with us, it most certainly is there. So when we come together as a unit on stage, it's a two-way, it's a symbiotic thing between the band and the audience. And I think that connection is what sustains us, and it sustains them with us.
You'll take the high road, and I'll take the low road, and I'll be
You know, Malcolm and I are terrible for, ad-libbing on stage. Him and I are kind of, we have musical conversations on stage, you know, that are just off the cuff.
If we go back a bit further, Pete Agnew of Nazareth shines a light on what it meant to him to play live.
When it got to the 70s, it became... it was quite funny because it was over the Woodstock thing happened in 69. It became quite cool to sit down on the floor and cross your legs, you know, and be a hippie and listen to the music, which was great for the bands. It was good because people were actually, you know, stopping to listen to you.
She used to be someone you could depend on.
You see, I laugh in the likes of the cinema, ballroom and stuff. You know, the bouncers, they were walking about. Kelly's like, get up your feet, get up, you can't sit there. they weren't quite up to, you know, up to the mark with what was happening in the rest of the world. So, but mainly the places were the dance halls, and it was dancing that that was your main job. You were there to make them dance.
Pete's a Dunfermline native, as is Richard Jobson, key member and songwriter, alongside the late Stuart Adamson, of the Skids.
When they first started out in early 1977, we were, I would say, Clash copyists. You know, they were the big influence on us, more so than the Sex Pistols. And Stuart Adamson wrote all of the lyrics, and he was more political than I was in an obvious way, and he was more of a social realist in his writing. It was about gangland fighting in rural Fife. It was about new towns and how empty they were and soulless. And it was, of course, like song like Charles, which is about deindustrialization and automation and the end of the whole masculine identity.
Charles got a job in a factory. Sure, she metal from 6 to 3. Work extra hours for a better wage. But last in his task, quite needlessly.
We started to change when he saw the lyrics that I was writing, which were more influenced by Bowie, more influenced by Lou Reed's, and maybe kind of more further afield, strange stuff like Television, Patti Smith, and William Burroughs, for example. And this was a kind of music that Stuart wasn't so into, but he grew into through me. He was more interested at the time in lyrics that in some way reflected how you saw it in front of you, whereas I try to see beyond that in my lyrics. I don't think my lyrics were any better than his. They were just different. And he started to kind of hook into what I was writing about, and then we would talk about it in great detail, you know. So we became very, very close as we tried to forge this identity. But the Skids' identity really came through Stuart's guitar playing, and which was totally unique. And he gave us a sound that I think, with my more aggressive front person position, certainly in musical terms, I was talentless. I mean, Stuart was a very accomplished musician, and he thrived off working with really good musicians. And I wasn't a good musician. I mean, I brought me to the table. I was really aggressive in those days, and you know, I was, every gig would be a fight, and I was a fighter. I mean, I was a tough little guy.
Fights, on-stage relationships, and attentive audiences aren't all there is to performing live. Fish, erstwhile singer with Marillion, left the band at the height of their popularity. Here he is to pick up the story.
Keighley took us into another division. After that, we had the Clutching at Straws album. You know, I was writing an album where, you know, all the experiences I was using within the lyrics were all taken from the road. And the excesses of being on the road, etc., etc. And in 1988, I just got to the point where I didn't enjoy where we were at as a band.
But some people would have thought, you know, Fish leaving Marillion, that's a bad move. I mean, why would he do that? The band they've never been more popular. It's never been more successful.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, that's why people always go on about reunions, because I didn't leave the band after a duff album. You know, I left after Clutching at Straws, which I consider was the best album we ever made. I was tired. You know, the machine had taken over. I got tired of going out, and we were playing 12,000, 15,000 people a night in Europe. And it was the most unenjoyable experience I'd ever had.
Why?
Because you're walking out and you don't see the people. You don't see faces. You've got two Super Troopers in your eyes, right? And there's no banter you can do. You know, it's not like, you know, even if you're playing in 3,000, somebody shouts out from a balcony, you can answer and everybody hears it. You didn't have that connection with the audience. The band were playing exactly the same set every night, the same solos. Everything was exactly the same, and I got tired of it. And then you're coming backstage and you're meeting people who, you know, 2 years ago had no interest in the band, who are, you're paying for all the champagne, all the canapes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all the people you wanted to meet, you couldn't meet, because you had to meet all, you had to shake hands and press the flesh with all these other people. We needed a break from each other.
When it was time for Fish to leave Marillion, he retreated back north of the border to Scotland.
I had to extract myself from London for family reasons as well. You know, my wife and I was going to lose a marriage if I didn't move out of London for various reasons. We'd done writing sessions in 1988 with Marillion up in a place called Dalnaglar Castle. And I started to get back into being Scottish, you know. I just really enjoyed being around the vibe. And it was an exciting time as well, because politically what was happening. And it was a very important move for me. I think, you know, coming back up, you know, I got the space and I got away from a lot of the darker, more negative kind of influences that were hanging around myself and the band at that time. You know, moving back was really strange. I remember the first time I went down the high street, and I'm walking down the high street, people are going, morning, 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 morning. And I'm going, why is he talking? Does he know who I am? Right, right. Then until I realised that that's what Scottish people are like. You know, they greet other people, like they greet strangers, morning, how you doing? And then I was up here for 6 months and it was great. And I went back into it again, just being relaxed and not being so insular. And then I went down and recorded the Vision of the Wilderness and Mirror albums down in London. I was walking along. And I remember walking up to the studio. It was up in Chiswick, so I decided to walk for the hotel. And I'm walking along and she goes, morning, how you doing? And people were jumping back into hotel doorways. right? And he was like, I'm going, do they think you're some axe-wielding homicidal maniac, you know? But I love the sense of community. I love people, you know, I like being around people.
You're listening to The Story of Scottish Pop with me, Vic Galloway. A little earlier, Sam McTrusty told us how dedicated Twin Atlantics Scottish fans are, but why was their most recent album, GLA, centred specifically around their Scottish hometown?
Well, firstly, we called it that because, like I was saying, we've been on this journey for over a decade where it was all about fighting to leave here. Because we just didn't feel like Glasgow in particular was really offering us much when we were teenagers. Like, there was like a bit of a template to like do your exams, go to uni, get a real job, settle down and everything. And we don't really feel like we were kind of cut from that cloth at that age. So we wanted to go on the road, be in a band. It was the thing that kind of felt the most natural. Because that started going quite well and we were, you know, playing festivals overseas and we toured around America for like 2 years and everything. Every day you were talking about your home and telling people what it's like in Glasgow, and over that time I started to fall back in love with the place because you're kind of promoting it and standing up for it as well. When people are either having a go at your accent or shouting mid-set, someone's shouting some Braveheart quote or something and you're like, nah, Scotland's more than that, man. We're actually like, we've got something to offer rock music.
I took you for granted and stayed away for too long. I thought I couldn't stand you, such a violent animal.
And that's really what the whole record was about. We wanted to have a body of work that was a little bit more kind of thought through. We kind of turned our back on it, the idea of it being like a commercial thing or anything, because we were kind of going in that direction. And we wanted to just write about what we knew the most and the best, which was our home city. And it given us so much support over the years. I had a lot of stuff to say about it.
It's almost like a concept album about Glasgow.
It is. And that's the first time I've actually admitted that. But it's only in retrospect I can say that. At the time, we just wanted to make an album in Glasgow. We're being really selfish. Like, we just didn't want to go anywhere else. We didn't want to go to a studio in England, or we didn't want to have our record label at the time really be a part of it. So we thought, well, they're definitely not going to come here because... They don't really want to come and spend time here. No producer does, or anyone that we'd worked with before. So we saw that as quite a good escape. Ironically, being at home as an escape, we started to realise that the influence that Glasgow has was becoming more and more apparent, because it was a lot kind of edgier for us. It was like a grittier, even like the tones and stuff were being a lot more bold and abrasive with distortion. The drums were becoming way more percussive, and like I started to kind of look at it a bit more from an artist's perspective than just like a kind of meathead rock thing that rock kind of gets tarred with that brush quite often.
Do you get asked about being Scottish when you're abroad?
Every day.
Really?
Multiple times a day. And it used to be quite annoying, but now I feel like I'm quite comfortable in my skin and our band has achieved something for, you know, the genre of Scottish rock music that kind of can stand on its own 2 feet separate from the other amazing Scottish rock bands. So I feel quite comfortable answering it now, and I'm a wee bit of a tour guide. I should work for like the Visit Scotland or something, because I really think that Scotland's one of the most amazing countries in the world, and we're like really proud to be from here.
You're my mother tongue, my mother tongue, my mother tongue. You're my mother tongue, my mother tongue, my mother tongue.
Place and identity are fundamental to so much music. Here's Richard Jobson in the heart of his hometown Dunfermline in a building essential to the formative shape of the Skids.
Well, we're sitting in Dunfermline Museum, which is this new beautiful building that's attached to the Carnegie Library in Dunfermline. This is a place that's of deep importance to me personally, because as a kid, we lived in a very small house and there was five boys and, you know, it was very difficult, so I had no space. So after school, I went to the school just up the road, St. Columbus. I'd come straight here and I'd write what was my private poetry, you know. It was a interesting combination of people, especially the winter, because you'd have a lot of people weren't in those days, they wouldn't regard them as being called homeless, but they lived in hostels, and they're men, mostly men, and they all had kind of problems mostly with alcohol, but they'd be sitting in there, and some of them, you know, were great. You'd been hanging out, writing my words, and out of that came Sense of Coming, Working for the Yankee Dollar, Into the Valley. All of those songs were written in this space. So when they came to me and said, we would like to do a kind of exhibition that celebrates the Skids and some of the other things you've done, we as a band are constantly doing things in the town, giving things back, doing little shows for various charities, etc., that we feel very strongly about. So I still feel an incredible link to this town, and I'm really grateful for all the things it did for me. And it was a privilege to be here. Even though it was tough, it was a privilege.
Of all the musicians I talk to making these programmes, Scotland, in its many guises, is at the core of those artists. And you might be surprised that Shirley Manson, of multi-million-selling electro-rockers Garbage, is still so passionate about her homeland.
How it looks, how it's underpopulated, how it thinks. I enjoy the climate, ironically. I don't enjoy being in LA weather at all. It does not agree with me. I'm only happy when it rains.
You're ginger.
I'm ginger. And I love the culture here. I love the history and I just, I don't know. My heart is here. It always will be.
Some people turn their back on the country that they're born and brought up in. You haven't. That's still important to you.
That's still really important to me, yeah. But, you know, you got to remember too, I grew up in a loving home. I had a great school. I had a great experience growing up here. So, of course, I'm going to feel nothing but love for it. And then I know a lot of my compatriots who I've met over the years weren't so lucky. Sometimes, you know, you escape your culture because you're escaping history that you don't want to remember. You have to separate yourself from it in order to live free. And I get that, you know. Mm-hmm.
I've heard that one of the proudest moments in your musical career was playing the opening of the Scottish Parliament.
I always still get a thrill when I think about it. It was a spectacular night.
Can you describe being asked, the whole experience of that event?
We were on tour and I got the call from management. It came to me and they were like, you know, are you interested in playing this show? And I can remember, like, it was like falling in love. I had that sort of flush of adrenaline. I couldn't believe that out of all the Scottish artists, they would come to our door and ask us. And yeah, I was so proud, and my mum and dad, it meant so much to them, and the evening was so beautiful. I remember being in the gardens underneath the castle, and I mean, you know, you travel as much as I do, you understand how rare that is to be in a location like that, you know. And it was a location in my hometown, you know. I can't put it into words, actually. It was really overwhelming. I can remember it as if it was yesterday. The crowd were amazing. Everybody sang at the top of their voices. And it was a moment of great hope for Scotland.
Mm-hmm. What were the Americans in the band? How did they feel about it? Did they realise?
No, they didn't understand.
Really?
Which made me want to literally obliterate them.
It was just another gig.
Just another gig. For the most part. I mean, I'm maybe being a little unfair. But they didn't quite understand it, I don't think.
And the Ross Bandstand, I mean, you must have been at gigs or just walked past it about a million times,
yeah,
in your childhood.
A million billion times.
And there you were headlining it at this momentous time.
Yeah, no, it was simple. It was a day. It was a day.
The world is not enough. Oh,
Shirley Manson enthusing about her homeland, finishing off this episode of The Story of Scottish Pop. I'm Vic Galloway, and as I delve further into Scotland's musical story, I'll look at the alternative and indie side of the Scottish music scene in due course, but next week I return to discover more about Scottish dance music.